this week's 51%, we speak with the founder of a daily tech service to promote progressive policies.
But after the Women's March, people went home and, oh my God, like, he's president and I can't march with 100,000 really cool women this weekend. So what do I do? So that's when we started getting about 10,000 people every day.
We'll hear about a Marine Corps photo scandal and how sexual assault survivors heal in harmony. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
What a difference a day made. 24 little hours. What the sun and the flowers.
Daily Action is a daily tech service to promote progressive policies via phone call activism. In fact, Daily Action's tagline is resisting extremism, one phone call at a time. Subscribers receive a daily text message about an issue and a hotline number they can click to call. Once they click the number and listen to a recorded summary of the issue, callers are connected to their lawmakers or the target of the action. Journalist Laura Moser founded Daily Action after Donald Trump was elected president to provide subscribers with quick, concrete ways to fight back against his policies. I spoke with Moser about her plans for Daily Action and more about what prompted her to start it.
Well, like many people, I've never been involved in politics before, except my husband works in politics. But like a lot of people, I was just really upset and surprised by the election in November. I just didn't see it coming. And it made me question a lot of my, you know, like what I was doing with my life, where this country was going. And I just wanted to do more than I'd been doing before. And my background is I'm a journalist and writer. It took me about a month to come up with the idea of giving people one action item a day to do, because I felt really overwhelmed by all this stuff on Facebook and on Twitter, do this, sign that, call this person. And I thought there's no way people can, you know, stay involved in this kind of resistance activity while having a job and while having kids and while digging your car out from the snow and all the things we have to do in life. So I committed to doing one action a day using this text message system. And I thought it would be hard at first to come up with an action every day. And it's actually, the hard part has been choosing among 30 different things every day.
So say among those 30, what puts an idea at the top of the list?
It's just, I work with a friend of mine in San Francisco, and it's just sort of gut, I have to say. One thing we do is if we think there's a vulnerability, then we try to poke away at that. That's definitely one criteria. Like, we knew that Andy Puzder was a vulnerable nominee for Labor. So we did a lot of actions on him because we thought if we can really generate a lot of calls about this guy who's already kind of teetering, then maybe we can shove him out. And the same with Rex Tillerson. Unfortunately, he is Secretary of State, but we thought that he had a lot of vulnerability. So we did a lot of calls to try to, you know, we thought, oh, maybe Marco Rubio won't vote for him. So let's call Marco Rubio. So that's one of our criteria.
So what are some examples of text you've gotten a lot of response to, action on? I mean, is this measurable?
Yeah, we can measure exactly how many calls go out every day from our text and how long the people are on the phone. I think our biggest action was, even though Steve Bannon, people are really afraid of Steve Bannon, as they should be, and even though White House advisors don't require Senate confirmation, we had an action where people called their senators and said, tell your senators to block these nominations until Bannon is out of the White House. And people really responded to that one, because I think the fact that Steve Bannon has so much power and that he's not a democratically chosen advisor, because, you know, that's how it works, that's fine, really scares people. And another big action that we did was when the first Muslim ban was announced. Again, that's an executive action. It's hard. There's no direct impact that a senator can have except for in blocking other things. So we called Customs and Border Protection offices all over the country. We entered every phone number from, you know, every international airport in the country and had people calling and asking, how many people have you detained today? And these people just work for the government. They're not the deciders, and they didn't like those calls. But that night, CBP actually announced how many people they were detaining. They issued a statement as a result of the kind of 25,000 calls we placed to their offices that day.
Do you consider Daily Action successful, and if so, why?
Yeah, I mean, we have tens of thousands of people who've never been involved in politics. And we've had some victories, like when they were going to gut the office of whatever, the ethics office. And we made so many calls that they reversed that decision. But one thing that I think at this point, you know, people are getting a little tired because the successes are not as massive as it's hard to say. I mean, we still have Donald Trump as president. People are starting to feel really fatigued. And I just kind of try to remind people every day that it's a longer arc than that, that we have to keep doing this every day and we have to keep making our voices heard and making these phone calls every day because, like, we don't have the votes to stop a lot of these things that are happening. But if we stay active, we can get the votes by 2018. And then this long nightmare will only be a two-year nightmare. So success, yes, but it's not as immediately gratifying as I think many people would like.
Laura, how many subscribers do you have?
We have about more than 260,000.
And how did they find out about Daily Action? How did word get out? And do you credit the energy from the women's marches the day after the inauguration of Donald Trump as president with helping to fuel your Daily Actions?
Yeah, I do. I just wrote an article in Vogue in mid-December, and I shared it. I mean, I put it public on my Facebook page, and a lot of people shared it, and Vogue shared it, and that was it. I mean, we had immediate growth, kind of thousands of people every day, but it was after the Women's March that it really exploded because I think people had been really focused on the Women's March as this, and the reality of Trump's presidency was still a little far off and abstract. But after the Women's March, people went home and, oh my God, like, he's president and I can't march with 100,000 really cool women this weekend. So what do I do? So that's when we started getting about 10,000 people every day.
How do you see maintaining Daily Action over the years, and will you be branching out?
Yeah, that is what we are working on right now. We just started a book club where once a month we read a book about activism, I mean, some sort of activism, and then we have a discussion with the author, and we had our first event this week, and my brother, who's a book critic, led it, and it was amazing. We read this book, How to Survive a Plague, which was about how people with AIDS basically fought the government and the indifference of America to find a cure for AIDS and to sort of apply these different lessons to what we're going through now. So that's one thing we're doing. We're also trying to do, and that's been really great. Our next book is about evictions and affordable housing. So we're kind of covering this whole gamut of ways that, you know, citizens can make a difference.
So you're in Washington, D.C. You have this book club. How does someone, say, in New York or California or Iowa get involved?
So you text the word club to 228-466. That's how you, if you want to join our list, you just write daily to 228-466. But if you want, we have other subgroups. At this time, we're just having the events on Facebook. But that's what I was going to say is our next step is we would like to have more in-person meetups for our next event as a kind of platform for meeting about other things. So to find your local bookstore, we're going to, if you're in Portland, you go to PAWS. If you're in San Francisco, you go to City Lights and just meet other activists. And we'd like to do that. That's kind of our next step, is to try to get people physically in the same room together to focus on 2018 and to focus on the elections and to find really good people to run in those elections, even if it's school board. Democrats tend to ignore these down ballot elections. So that's really our next direction that we're trying to go in, is to get people focused on their communities. So you find 10 people in your town who've also read the book, and either you get together and watch the webcast, or you get together and say, hey, let's run for county commissioner, or, you know, let's find the closest swing district, all these things that need to happen soon. It's just been an amazing ride for me because I thought I'd have a couple thousand people, you know, doing this, and people want to do stuff. People want to get involved. I just hope they stay. I hope that desire isn't extinguished by despair.
That was Laura Moser, founder of Daily Action, a daily tech service to promote progressive policies. Daily Action is produced in collaboration with Creative Majority PAC, a political action committee of the creative class, empowered by Revolution Messaging, led by members of Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Moser's husband, by the way, served in former President Obama's administration as videographer. Laura Moser has written for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Slate, and many other publications. A North Carolina investigative journalist recently revealed that hundreds of Marines may have shared nude photos of female colleagues and friends on social media. The revelations came as military leaders fight an ongoing battle to change the Marine Corps culture. Jay Price reports.
The Marines are famous for their close-knit team spirit, a cohesion that Marine leaders say the photo sharing has undermined. In a video posted by the Pentagon, Marine Commandant General Robert Neller was blunt.
We are all in 24/7. And if that commitment to your excellence interferes with your me time, or if you can or are unwilling to commit to contributing 100% to our Corps' warfighting ability by being a good teammate and improving cohesion and trust, then I have to ask you, do you really want to be a Marine?
In short, if you treat fellow Marines like this, you aren't a real Marine. The brass says that's not up for debate, but comments posted under online stories about the scandal make it clear that some Marines disagree, like this one in the Marine Corps Times. Quote, how about giving homage to a female that takes care of her body and looks good? We can do that anymore? Unquote. The Marine Corps says people with attitudes like that are a minority, but while all the service branches have had gender discrimination issues, some observers say the Marines in particular have a boys' club tone.
It's not just a Marine Corps problem, but I think it's probably the worst case of it, or the worst example of it from the Marine Corps.
Ellen Herring is a retired Army colonel and one of the earliest female graduates of West Point. She now does research on gender integration in the military. Herring cited a RAND Corporation study in 2014 that found Marine women experienced the highest rate of sexual assault in the military. And she notes this isn't the first time Marine men have been caught sharing inappropriate photos. Herring says a big part of the problem is the Marines are the only service that separates men and women for many of the physical parts of boot camp.
Women are put into their own separate little battalion. They're trained differently. They're trained separately. Their training isn't as tough, and their standards aren't as high. And so when they graduate, they become the targets. You know, they're seen as an other Marine. Somebody once said it's like you have an asterisk by your name. You're a Marine, but not the real Marine.
The Marine Corps says that men and women are together for more than 60% of boot camp, including classes, and that men are trained there to treat females as equals.
Throughout recruit training, there's what we call core value guide discussions that are led by the senior drill instructor.
Captain Gregory Carroll is a spokesman for Marine Corps Recruit Depot Paris Island, where all female recruits and many male recruits go for basic training.
But you take that male drill instructor, and he's going to talk to his recruits kneecap to kneecap and discuss with them various subjects, you know, to include equal opportunity, for example. He's going to explain to them, you know, what is right and what is wrong, and develop that individual not only into a basic trained Marine, but, you know, an ethical warrior.
Retired Marine Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold agrees with the Commandant that the men sharing the photos weren't behaving like real Marines.
It really is deeply offensive that a Marine would treat another Marine like this.
He says fixing it will take support from officers, but that this misogyny can only be erased from the Corps' culture by the frontline enlisted leaders, like sergeants and corporals.
They're the role models for behavior, and they have the opportunity to stop this.
The scandal comes as the Marines are trying to boost the number of women in their ranks, long stalled at around 7%. The Army's percentage of women is about twice as high, and the Navy and Air Force are even higher. A year ago, Neller, the Commandant, said he wanted to get the Marines to 10% women. With this scandal, reaching that goal got harder. This is Jay Price reporting.
Meanwhile, U.S. Senator from New York Kirsten Gillibrand questioned Robert Neller, Commandant of the Marine Corps, March 14th at the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing on the illicit images of female service members, veterans, and civilians circulated by U.S. Marines, former Marines, and civilians. Here's Gillibrand, a Democrat.
Who has been held accountable? I very much align myself with Senator Fisher's comments. Who has been held responsible? Have you actually investigated and found guilty anybody? If we can't crack Facebook, how are we supposed to be able to confront Russian aggression and cyber hacking throughout our military? It is a serious problem when we have members of our military denigrating female Marines who will give their life to this country in the way they have, with no response from leadership. I can tell you, your answers today are unsatisfactory.
After continuing, Gillibrand ended by asking,
so if you're dedicated to fixing the culture of the Marines and all the services, what do you plan to do to hold commanders responsible who fail to get this done?
Here is Marine Corps Commandant Robert Neller's response.
Senator, I understand and share your concern. If I were aware or any, I would expect that any commander was aware if someone was reported any allegation of anything, but particularly something as serious as sexual assault, and the chain of command didn't do anything, that that commander would be held accountable.
After a few more responses, he ended with this.
I'm still in the process. I mean, I don't have a good answer for you. I'm not going to sit here and duck around this thing. I'm not. I'm responsible. I'm the commandant. I own this, and we are going to have to, you know, you've heard it before, but we're going to have to change how we see ourselves and how we do, how we treat each other. That's a lame answer, but ma'am, that's the best I can tell you right now. We've got to change, and that's on me.
That was U.S. Senator from New York Kirsten Gillibrand and Marine Corps Commandant Robert Neller during the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing on the Marine Corps photo scandal. Sexual assault is not an easy thing to talk about, and one group in Minnesota is trying to help survivors use their voices again. KFAI's Sophie Nikitas reports.
In a room in the First Congregational Church in northeast Minneapolis, a woman starts singing.
This is the sound of one voice. This is the sound of one voice.
Then another woman joins her.
This is the sound of voices too. The sound of me.
These women are part of a choir, but they're not a religious choir.
So this specific choir for me, it's just been more powerful than any choir I've ever been involved with because it's all survivors and they all get it.
That's Erica Hanna, and she's a member of the group. It's called Survivor Voices, and it's a choir for survivors of sexual assault. The choir is open to everyone, but happens to be all women right now. The group sprang out of an organization called Break the Silence. It's an ad hoc group of survivors of sexual assault. Sarah Super is the group's founder. In 2015, an ex-boyfriend broke into her apartment and raped her at knife point. You might have seen it in the news. The press doesn't generally name rape victims, but Super didn't want to remain anonymous. She, like more and more survivors in the past few years, asked the press to identify her as the victim of the crime. She asked the Star Tribune to let her tell her story in her own words.
I learned just how many people in my own life were also survivors of sexual violence and was very shocked by the lack of knowledge that I had about how many survivors were in my life and let alone how many survivors are in our community and how pervasive sexual violence is.
So she formed Break the Silence. They host truth-telling events where people publicly share their stories of rape and abuse. They're lobbying the city of Minneapolis to build the first ever monument to sexual assault survivors. And they've started this choir.
And we're really striving to create communities where survivors can feel free to share their stories and say their names and trust that they can be met with validation and compassion and trauma-informed support.
For the women in the choir, rehearsals are not about rehashing their assaults. The point is simply to be in community with people they know they can relate to. It's about having fun and letting loose. Here's Super again.
Coming to that point where it's like, it's okay to have fun here. Like, this is not, we're not going to just like, this isn't a therapy session. We're not going to sit around and tell our stories and sob. You know, not that we're against that either, but that we felt comfortable even just being silly and being fun.
At first I was afraid, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side.
There's a lyric in I Will Survive about I should have locked the door and changed the key. And, you know, for me, it's like my rape happened with a home invasion. And so even songs that are about surviving also carry kind of memories to them and some connections to even our own personal stories.
It's not a therapy session, but the women in the group agree that singing together gives them tools to heal. Choir member Erica Hanna again.
Now I find myself putting on the songs that we sing here in Survivor Voices when I'm at home, if I'm having a bad day or a flashback or whatever that is, and it brings me back to that safe place, to knowing like I get to see them next week.
And it makes her feel less alone.
So for me, being next to all these other survivors, it's this feeling of solidarity and strength, actually, and power. And I think when you are a survivor, people think of you as someone who's had their power taken away from them. And so it's like we're giving it back to each other in support.
For KFAI, I'm Sophie Nikitas.
Sexual assault can be especially horrific if it happens far away from home. Research shows that American college students studying abroad are sexually assaulted at least as often as they are in the U.S., and there are few places they can turn for help. John Thomas from the University of North Carolina reports.
Walk into UNC senior Emily Crockett's bedroom, and one thing is clear. She loves art.
This entire wall is Botticelli, one of my favorite artists.
Particularly art by Italian Renaissance artist Sandro Botticelli. A large poster of Primavera, one of his paintings, hangs prominently over her bed.
This is not an accurate representation of this painting at all. Like, seeing it in person is just stunning.
She did see it in person when she was studying abroad in Italy in 2014.
This was the summer after my first year. So not the bad year, but summer before that.
The bad year came the following summer when she returned to the country for an internship. One night, on the way back home to her apartment, Crockett was sexually assaulted, a memory that continues to haunt her.
Still hurts a lot. A lot of PTSD episodes and different kinds of coping mechanisms.
Crockett's boss, who was fluent in English and Italian, helped her report the assault. But she still had to navigate an unfamiliar legal system in a foreign country where she knew almost no one.
All of it's so confusing, and I know I got to the point where I was like, I don't want to make any decisions. Like, someone needs to do this for me. Like, I can't even imagine being alone.
Other college students know that feeling, too. Bucknell University professor Bill Flack helped publish two studies in 2012 about sexual assault among students studying abroad. They found it to be at least as common, and perhaps much more common, than sexual assault on college campuses in the U.S.
I think we assume that when students study abroad that, by and large, they're going to be safe. I think that's a false assumption.
Flack's studies are among the first of their kind ever to be published. He and a handful of other experts are continuing to research the subject, and one group is trying to directly help survivors. Sexual Assault Support and Help for Americans Abroad, or SASHA, offers a 24/7 international hotline. Assistant Director Brooke Galloway says SASHA can find doctors for students, discuss the pros and cons of reporting the assault, help them fly home, and even figure out how to tell their parents.
I think having a lifeline of support, someone who's there to just answer the phone, but also to help them navigate, what do I do right now? Oh my gosh, I'm in this foreign country. I can't speak the language. I don't know who to turn to.
Crockett says she wished she had known about SASHA because it would have given her somewhere else to turn for help.
Through the university, like, I was not aware of any type of hotline or if something bad happens. It was kind of more of, don't let something bad happen, because if it does, you're screwed.
Now, she blogs about her experiences and frequently talks with other survivors. And she finds comfort in art, including a tattoo on her left arm that she designed herself. It's a blue and purple bird in flight.
It's a good reminder to be able to kind of remember that I will fly again, even if it's hard and things suck.
In Chapel Hill, I'm John Thomas.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1444.